You're listening to the One Room with a View show with Christopher Preston and Dan Orton.
Merry Christmas and welcome to the One Room with a View show with me, Christopher Preston, and joining me, he's a mean one, it's Mr. Dan Orton.
Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you.
Yes.
So let's not do a Christmas special now.
I thought we were about to break into song.
Are we not exchanging presents? Take it back. Take it all back. Right, talking of taking everything back, Dan, yes, what's coming up on today's show?
I'm glad you asked. Right, so today, in our December podcast, final podcast of 2017, as you may have already guessed, listeners, we are talking about Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, directed...
Small Kickstarter movie.
Yes, very small. Yeah.
Yeah, you put a fiver in for that as well, didn't you?
I did. I'm getting a T-shirt in return. thanks for your support, your forceful support. That was obviously written and directed by Rian Johnson, whose debut feature film was 2005's Brick, so that's our awesome film, Old. Very excited to talk about both those films.
Which, interestingly, I think is a Kickstarter. Well, or at least...
Well, I mean, it cobbled together on a shoestring budget years and years ago and has catapulted the man to Star Wars.
Yeah, fascinating to talk about.
It's an incredible elevation for any director. And then, because we want to talk a lot about Star Wars, really, because, I mean, we're both big Star Wars fans.
Yeah, and this movie in particular demands airtime.
I think so.
Absolutely. As the internet has now shown.
So we're doing a sort of bumper edition of Some Film Old, Some Film New. We've jettisoned most of the other sort of things we'd normally do, so no Dad's Describing Films this month.
But they will be
no
back,
Netflix,
we promise.
But they will, of course, be back, yes, in the new year. The only other thing we're going to bring to this month's show is, of course, our annual top 10 list.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing what you've got to say about that, actually. So,
as am I.
I think we should probably crack on.
Yes, let's.
Some film old, some film new.
Thank you, Christopher. It's recorded live, as always.
Yep.
So, as
my doctor's got several things to say about that, actually.
My Christopher due is some Strepsils.
Yeah, it's kind of half Snoke, half Ray, I think, what I've gone for there.
Yes, lovely segue. So, some film old, some film new. We are looking, as I mentioned at the top of the show, at Star Wars The Last Jedi and Brick, which was Rian Johnson's first feature film?
It was his first feature-length film, yeah. It was a movie that he wrote, I think, just after graduating film school. I think I was reading something like he kept pitching it to various studios, producers, whatever, and just couldn't... They just didn't see how a first-time director would be able to make this good. And so he ended up... I think he raised something like £450,000 of the budget himself. And so this really is kind of like an independent filmmaker striving out to do something new.
No, yes. And we'll just do plots quickly then.
Yeah.
We'll start with Brick. Brick is essentially... I mean, the way I sort of came away from it was it's like a sort of murder mystery noir film.
Yeah, this hard-boiled sort of, detective story,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, but set in the microcosm of high school. So you've got this awkward loner played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt who is trying to work out the circumstances behind the disappearance of his ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, played by, is it Emily DeRaven?
Yes, yeah, who most people probably know from Lost.
Claire from Lost, that's how I knew her.
The Aussie from Lost.
Yeah, the one who had the baby in Lost.
It's a sort of sprightly 2 hours, and it follows Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Brandon as he solves the mystery of his missing ex-girlfriend.
He looked eerily like Heath Ledger in this movie, and I know that people have often commented on how they do look alike.
Yes.
I think it's probably something to do with the youthful face and kind of frizzy hair, but yeah, it made me certainly think of the late, great Heath.
Now you mention that, I can see that.
Eerily so.
Yeah.
Do you want me to do The Last Jedi?
Yeah, what's that about?
So it picks up moments, really, after The Force Awakens, and it is the story of Rey's training phase, essentially, as well as bringing us back to Mark Hamill's Luke Skywalker 30 years down the line.
Mm.
And it kind of is set in the backdrop of a vastly diminished rebellion as seemingly last stand against the First Order.
The Resistance are in dire straits throughout this film.
And battered from the beginning to end. So I suppose, yeah, it's like an intergalactic game of perilous squash.
Perilous squash. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how Ryan Johnson
I am plagiarising the tagline somewhat there, but
Star Wars: The Last Jedi, perilous squash.
But that's kind of, I suppose that's it in a nutshell, albeit a surrealist nutshell.
Yes, well, let's see if we can try and crack that nut a bit further as we go on through the discussion.
I think we can.
We chose Brick because there's a myriad films we could have chosen in some film old to go alongside.
I think the obvious one, like if we were going to bring it down to Ryan Johnson, the obvious one probably would have been the sci-fi Looper from a few years ago. Yeah. And I think that's why we purposefully...
Also starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, and I think that's why we purposefully chose not to do that one, because Brick, I think, maybe not necessarily has more in common with Star Wars, but at least it's nice to see where some of these ideas came from.
Well, I chose Brick. Well, I plumped for Brick because I haven't ever seen it until now for the podcast. And it's always exciting. The one thing I love about doing this review is that there's always this opportunity to watch films and come across things that we've never...
Yeah, the curio pieces.
Yeah, never come across before. I remember when Brick came out, I remember I had a friend at school who was really into it. He thought it was great.
That's mad that you said that, because that's exactly what happened to me. I don't know if this bloke was... his name was Ryan, I think. He's just pamphleting people about this movie. Going from school, obviously not a school student.
Yeah, he had a beard.
Right? Yeah, he was an exchange student and came to my school. He was there for... I think he was there for a day, thinking about it now.
He very obviously looked about 30.
Yeah, he was a beard, little fella.
It was guerrilla tactics. There was a lad, marketing tactics.
There was a lad at my school who, it wasn't as it came out, it was a few years later, because this came out in 2003-ish, did it?
2005.
Okay, so it must have been a couple of years later when I was in sixth form, so probably a year or 2 years later, around 06, 07.
Yeah.
And he kept talking about it and kept talking about it. And I bought this DVD in the HMV in Exeter in my master's year, just as we were finishing the radio show. So it's taken me all this time to get round to be provided with an opportunity to watch it. And I'm pleased to have. It certainly lived up to the intrigue that it was sold to me by.
Yes.
That hard-boiled detective story in, as you said, the microcosm
And I remember my friend being incredibly, like... you know, fired up about this whole thing. Like, you know,
well, he made it, so he wanted to make sure.
My friend was Ryan Johnson. If you haven't got that joke already, listener, we're implying...
the gift that keeps on giving.
We're implying that Ryan Johnson...
uber famous Ryan Johnson, who has never, ever met us before.
Was really big on this idea, you know, it's really a noir film in a high school setting. But done in... Like everything it's filmed in a very, it's filmed very much like a noir film. The dialogue is very noir-like. I feel I'm being very lazy just describing everything as noir.
No,
you get what I'm saying.
You're absolutely right. And I think that leads to a finer point of that this should have been rubbish. And I think it could have been rubbish. Like,
it could have been an absolute disaster.
Like, almost like a kind of sketch show parody. Like, for me, this could have just been like a 2 second sketch in a, you know, Mitchell and Webb sketch show or something like that. But actually, to have turned it into to play it straight, which mostly it does.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever hugely descends into parody. The stakes feel quite high in it, at least.
Yes.
It does occasionally become a little bit too frivolous, I suppose.
They cast Richard Roundtree as the assistant vice principal.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes into this sort of almost like pastiche of
when he turns around and he's like, talking about writing him up for the way that you talk to me.
It's like Vice Principal Sharp is there, kind of like briefing Joseph Gordon-Levitt's rogue cop.
Yeah, no, you're
like,
right.
You ain't got nothing on me.
He does skirt round the edges of that sometimes.
Yeah, it's like, you're a maverick, Brandon.
I don't know. I think that you.
I want your hall pass.
if you are willing to... Yeah, everything becomes like McGonagall in The Simpsons, isn't it? Trying to eat my lunch here. I think that if you're willing to kind of take the concept and run, you're going to get quite a lot of fun, dare I say, out of this movie.
Yes. It wasn't what I was expecting.
I expected it to be a lot worse than it actually turned out to be.
And actually, I mean, I say that because I feel like a lot of Ryan Johnson's films, including The Last Jedi... they're never what I expected.
No, I think Breaking Bad, he's actually... I think I first came to know Rian Johnson through his consistent work in Breaking Bad. I think the two episodes that leaped to mind that he directed were The Fly.
Yes.
Which everyone... It was quite a divisive episode. I personally love that episode. I know a lot of people think it's a real dropped stitch, but I think it's an amazing...
There are two camps, aren't there? I think they're either you, if you think it's an amazing, as you say, piece of just it's a character study, an hour, 45 minutes of just really getting to know where Walter and Jesse are at this point, or you get the other side of the other camp where that people say, well, this is just a filler episode because they couldn't think of anything else to do.
I think I should just dismiss it.
They filmed this while they were getting other sets ready or something.
Whilst Rian Johnson was pamphleting local high schools. With DVDs of season two. He also...
Don't do drugs.
He also directs Ozymandias as well. Which is seen, I think, pretty much across the board.
One of the greatest episodes of television ever made.
And quite possibly the greatest episode of Breaking Bad, although I think I'd slightly disagree with that. So that's where I got to know him. He's someone who is consistently able to pull... the rug from underneath your feet. And that's what, I mean, leading us into the Last Jedi now, it really does live up to that little soundbite that Luke Skywalker says in the second trailer of, this is not going to go the way you expect.
Yeah, no, that's really that's really good. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. But yeah, you kind of have honed in on the perfect summary of the entire film. I came out of it thinking, that was incredible. I mean, I came out of it and I was, I was in a showing full of, family.
Star Trek fans.
Throwing things at the screen. It was most irregular. And some, 6-year-old kid came out with his dad. And his dad said, oh, what did you think then? And I heard the kid say, I think that might be the best film they've ever made, actually, in my opinion.
Get him on the show. It's a more nuanced opinion I'm going to deliver.
And I thought, actually, you're not far off. It was, and this is what I mean, and it was an incredible... film, an incredible addition to the Star Wars canon, and a lot of that is because Johnson took it in directions I wasn't expecting it. Because it could have, there are so many things that happen in this film which actually is like, okay, you know what, fair play, you got me there.
But it still retains that Star Wars magic though.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I went to go and see it at midnight at the BFI IMAX, and when you're in there, it's like, it's the biggest screen in Europe. And you've got, a few hundred fans in there that have all come out at midnight on a school night, essentially. And there's that kind of hive buzz that can only really be described as magic.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that it still interwove that. It is, I'd argue, it's probably the most radically different Star Wars movie. I think even more so than Rogue One, which pitched itself as an alternate Star Wars movie.
Yes. Yeah,
this felt even more roguish, if I dare say that word. There's such a twinkling glee to subversion in this movie, like right down to everything. Now, I am going to put up a flag at this point, Dan.
Yes.
We are going to spoil this movie. So if you haven't seen it from here on in, I think we're going to be quite direct in our spoilers.
Yeah, so I'd probably skip ahead into the pod for about, 10 minutes maybe.
Yeah, I'd go for that, yeah. So spoilers as of now.
So, it was a bold choice of them to introduce Luke with a rap, I thought.
You're completely nude as well. I don't know if that's contractually stipulated or...
No, but I bring up Luke's introduction there frivolously to talk... You were talking about subversion, and, I mean, we had that wonderful wonderful moment at the end of Force Awakens, Mark Hamill's only appearance, his only scene is this mute cameo with Rey there holding the lightsaber towards him. It's supposed to be like, I think J.J. Abrams was going for some, this is a new iconic image of the new trilogy.
And delivered, really. Yeah.
We go back to that scene, and Rian Johnson basically has Luke take the lightsaber. It's very sort of, it's done in a very reverent way.
Well, even the music, it carries on from The Force Awakens.
And then he tosses it over the cliff.
Yeah, he just lobs it behind
him. And you just think, okay, now we know this is where we're going with this now. That's just one of many...
Kind of irreverent subversions, really.
Left turns that I throughout the film.
Well, I went into this movie kind of with the expectation, or at least the bar that was set when Mark Hamill was speaking some time ago, when he said that and I'm paraphrasing this, but he said something along the lines of when he read the script, he turned around to Rian Johnson and said, I fundamentally disagree with every choice you've made for my character. However, it's now my job to go and make this, like, really good. And he succeeds. You know, Mark Hamill is absolutely superb.
He is.
Logan. I actually found that a lot of parallels between Logan and this movie. Like, if you imagine Logan being Luke Skywalker, Professor X is Yoda,
yes,
and Rey is X-23. I think you can actually see some quite nice
I can see some comparisons there, for sure. Some
cross-pollination between those two things.
I certainly think, I mean, I think it might be an Empire's review.
Sure.
Talked about how if The Force Awakens was Han Solo's film,
then this is
this one very much belongs to Luke Skywalker.
Definitely, I agree with that.
And it's a shame, obviously a tragic shame, that we won't get Leia's, arc completed in
episode
9.
I hear Guy Henry's in conversations just as we speak.
As well he should be.
He's brilliant. I told you that I chased him over London.
You did? Yeah.
I don't know if I said this to the listeners. If you remember back to this time last year, Dan and I really kind of almost started
waxing
an
miracle
order in the name of Guy Henry.
The first one?
Yeah. And it became, a bit of a topic of conversation between us about the fact that poor old Guy Henry didn't get any real accolade for the stellar job that he did. And
the stellar
job that he did. And as I was walking out of Charing Cross a month or so later, I bumped straight into him, and I turned around to my other friend and said,
that's Peter Cushing.
That's that's Guy Henry, isn't it? We chase him like the fugitive. Honestly, I couldn't keep up with the bloke. Honestly, I don't know if he's able to actually warp through time and space, but I assume that you're not listening, but if you are,
Mr. Henry,
Godspeed, yeah. But yeah, you're right. It's a tragic shame that we won't get Leia's. Although we do get a nice amount of her in this movie.
I have to say, certainly this is Luke Skywalker's film, but also this is a nice
almost epitaph,
this is a nice closing to the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
Because, the reality is we don't have any more Skywalkers really to talk, to stories to follow.
Yeah. There are a couple of things wrong with this movie, though, I think. Now, the big reveal, there's two big reveals, really, I suppose, but then there's a multitude of smaller reveals at the exact same time. But the two big ones that I think people will talk about will be Rey's parentage being revealed.
Yeah.
And Snoke's death, which both of them kind of left field, and both of which I thought were actually bold, but mostly excellent decisions, actually. Mm. I thought a lot of people online, because this movie's getting a lot of backlash online.
Yes.
If you look on Rotten Tomatoes, and I know we don't really care about that kind of stuff on the podcast, but if you juxtapose the Rotten Tomato critic score, which I think is 93%, which is tied with The Force Awakens and makes it the joint second best Star Wars movie critically on that particular website, it's only 57% in audience, which actually makes it
rotten. The great problem is, and you forgive me if you're about to get to this, at least my impression is, there's a lot of people out there who are obsessed with everything being linked. You know, that there's endless threads online about who Snoke really was.
Yeah, and Rey's parents.
And, is Rey Luke's daughter
or
somehow?
Kenobi?
And all this stuff. There seems to be this unhealthy obsession, I think, with everything being linked, with there being some sort of conspiracy. Was Snoke Mace Windu? You know, all these absurd...
the answer was clearly yes to that. Yeah.
And there seems to be a real resistance, a resistance to anyone accepting that there might be other people in this universe.
But that's why I like Rian Johnson's kind of double headbutt to those people,
exactly,
which I thought was really great. The idea that the idea that Rey's parents weren't just like, seemingly alcoholics who sold her off for drink money.
Kylo Ren reveals to her.
And as tragic as that is, but at the same time, it's a kind of masterful piece of directorial work or at least in world building, because now it takes us away from those kind of faintly ridiculous messianic Jedi tendencies now. And I really liked that. And I thought the undercutting of Snoke Because the thing is, if we carried Snoke on... Snoke
interesting into, choice of words there.
if we carry Snoke's story into the third one, he just becomes another Palpatine. There's nowhere else for him to go. I understand that we could have felt a little bit more... We could have coloured him in a little bit more and found out where he came from. And if he's this powerful...
He clearly uses the dark side of the Force quite effectively.
And that would have been interesting, I suppose, to have found that out. But at the same time, we carry him through to the third chapter and all you've got is another Palpatine-Vader dichotomy. Now, Ren has been self-promoted to the big job.
Yeah.
Having the wild dog, who's very mentally unstable, right at the top of the tree, totally reinvents that dynamic. And I thought that was masterful. I thought that was excellent.
I completely agree.
So they're not the choices that I disagree with. The two things that I really disagree with, I thought that Finn was phenomenally underserved by this movie. His whole tract in this story was stuff that I really could have been exercised from the entire film.
I can see your point. And I think there's a problem there that, well, I feel like Finn was introduced in the first film, in Force Awakens, as, you know, the... He was sold to us as the main protagonist, and
certainly in the teasers.
Yeah. So you know, all the marketing was like, "This is our big main character," and everyone. And throughout the film, you're led to believe that Finn is going to be, you know,
Force sensitive
and a Jedi, and then it's you know you got the old bait and switch, and it's Rey.
Yeah.
And then I think they all kind of thought, well, what should we do with Finn now?
And I thought Finn was probably. Maybe not, but certainly up there with the best in The Force Awakens. Like, I love John Boyega's performance. I thought he got most of the best lines. I thought his delivery was excellent. He was incredibly heroic throughout. And I loved that reinvention of the stormtrooper turning good kind of thing. I thought that was great. In this movie, I felt like a lot of it just it could have been taken out. And the second thing was that, and I understand why, but I didn't like the Luke Force hologram thing at the end. I thought that was a real misstep. I didn't like that. I thought it would have been much better for Luke to have actually faced down Kylo Ren rather than it be the Force Tupac Shakur from Coachella kind of style hologram, which I just didn't think worked. It felt contrived and it kind of took me out of it a little bit.
That was an interesting choice. I mean, I think there's an element of we've not seen... That's not established lore, is it? We're not familiar with a Jedi being able to transport himself,
or at least a vision of himself,
which is presumably seen by everyone in the vicinity.
Yeah, well, they do that. Most of them interact with them, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, we see earlier in the film, it's implied that obviously Snoke is able to manipulate Rey and Kylo Ren to see each other and communicate with each other. That's sort of we kind of go with that because we've seen that sort of thing. Touched upon in previous films.
And because there is something kind of telekinetic about the whole thing anyway, yeah. We're like, right,
but
okay.
The idea of like sending a phantom of yourself halfway across the galaxy, yeah. Which everyone is able to communicate with.
And the whole point of it being like Luke, because Luke ultimately dies anyway, or at least becomes one with the Force, whatever way you want to kind of do it. I felt that the whole thing was built around making sure that we got that binary sunset bookmark from A New Hope. You know, like he looks at the two sunsets. We have the theme binary sunset play,
and he becomes Skywalker, one. Always looking at sunsets.
Yeah, and he kind of becomes one with the Force. And I just thought that was kind of lazy. I'd rather they Kenobi'd him, and he'd actually turned up. He'd had his haircut. You know, and he'd face Kylo Ren down.
I thought that's where we were going.
That's the way I thought we were going down.
Especially when he says, you know, if you strike me down in anger, I'm only going to come back. You know, I'll always be with you
like your father.
That's an excellent mirroring.
Because Johnson had so fastidiously undercut any homaging, probably because of The Force Awakens, which I know a lot of people just think is kind of lazy almost in its homaging, but because he so furiously done that, I'd have allowed that homage at the end because I'd have thought that would have been fair enough. I thought the whole vision thing just didn't work for me. I thought that kind of felt lazy. However, the second time I watched it, I've rewatched this movie because the first time I saw it, I was like, right, I don't know what I'm thinking about this at the moment. And the second time I did it, I had my own fan theory, Dan, and I'll be putting this on Reddit.
Oh God!
Moments later, but I thought
this man does not represent me.
I thought that if you as Mark Hamill, just made a little call in there. I just you've travelled across time and space, Mark. Thanks so much.
Thanks for phasing in.
I thought that if you look at it, actually, that Luke's whole kind of obsession in this movie is that he is a man that has to live up to this idea of being a legend.
Yes.
And he's not that legend. He's much more broken than that. If you break it down to that, and you think in poetic terms of, well, the bloke who sat on the Jedi Temple area is Luke, and the hologram version of him is this smarter, straighter, lightsaber-wielding legend, actually, those two things kind of work, and that's quite a nice little idea. But I think you'd have to kind of force it a little bit.
It didn't bother me as much as it clearly bothers you.
It's caused a real crisis in my mind, but I don't know.
I was hoping for a full-out lightsaber duel. We don't get it.
I think that we didn't get the full-out lightsaber duel. My friend said exactly the same thing as when we walked out. Mm. Same thing that you just said. He went, "I felt let down because we didn't get given that epic Luke versus Ren." And I said, "As much as I think that we all wanted it, they couldn't give it to us because obviously Ren and Rey have got to have an epic one next episode."
Yes,
and
I think it'd be fun to cut that. There's always been a lightsaber duel.
Force
Awakens one was quite scrappy. I was looking forward to.
I thought the back-to-back one between all of the Snoke's guards was cool, though.
Yes.
The Ren-Ray one.
Yeah.
But
more of a dogfight than a duel between...
Yeah, perhaps. I still think that what this movie had really going for it, I'm sad that they didn't play up the duality more. I think it would have been genuinely bold and fascinating for us to have seen perhaps Ren turn good or Rey turn bad, certainly what the teasers and the trailers led us to believe, which surprised me that we didn't get hardly any of that, to be perfectly honest, in this movie. But what I do think was so interesting is the shades of grey that they're still presenting between the two extremes of the Force. Whereas in the Lucas's films and the old films, it's very binary, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, we've got to find balance.
We've got to find balance, Dan, yeah. And I think that Adam Driver is just exceptionally cast as Kylo Ren and Ben Solo. Still put it, like, magnificent performance for me.
Absolutely. He's certainly, I think, one of the more well-rounded villains. As you say, we have this very much in the previous films. It's very obvious. There's the light side, the dark side. And
like, I love Sidious. Is it Ian McDiarmid, isn't it?
Yeah, Ian McDiarmid.
I love him, but he's just a killing... villain, isn't he? There's no shade of grey to that guy.
Yeah.
Who's just out and out pure evil.
Yeah. I am the Senate.
Yeah, whereas I think that Ren is incredibly conflicted, and I think Driver is able to communicate that with us perfectly.
Yes.
We don't get as much of Rey and Ren as much as I expected in this movie, but that was able to elevate people like Poe Dameron. Oscar Isaac puts in a really
I was reading an interview with Rian Johnson and one of his producers, who also helped him produce... Brick, actually. He's been his producer all the way through.
He's fallen on his feet, hasn't he?
They were saying, you know, what we wanted to try and do, what we ended up sort of essentially doing was setting up these little triangles. So you had Rey and Ren and Luke, and then you had Finn and Rose and DJ, Benicio del Toro's character, and then you had Poe and Leia and Holdo.
Oh, cool.
And so when you had those sort of sorted out, it was a lot easier to kind of start putting the pieces together. And Poe Dameron's his story, we barely scraped the surface of all the wonderful people in this film. And all the interesting little subplots.
Yeah.
But, you know,
just go on IMDb, there's so many of them, it's ridiculous.
But Laura Dern as Vice Admiral Holdo, who for reasons in the film takes over as leader of the Resistance midway through, and you know you think her and Poe don't see eye to eye, but actually she's got everyone's best interests at heart, really, and
she's the leader they have to have.
She's not the leader as she's not a leader that we're perhaps familiar with in the Star Wars films.
Well, it's that nuance again, isn't it, that's coming in. It's just not those shades of absolute white and absolute darkness. Like, it's those in-between and the things that people have to do. And I thought that her trajectory... I mean, the whole stuff about... I loved that kind of concept that they had where it felt almost in real time. You know, the fleet is running out of power or whatever and all of that kind of stuff, which really worked. It also gave us... quite possibly, and I'd have to double-check this, but probably my favourite start to a Star Wars movie ever. Poe Dameron's like incredibly risky attack on the Dreadnought, which I think was so not only incredibly visually striking, but incredibly emotional as well. It sets up a lot of the film nicely.
And yes.
What it hammered home, what I liked about this movie, more so than most other Star Wars movies, is that futility and harrowing nature of war. You know, these last few good men and women who are being just bombarded by evil at all accounts, it's sort of having to maintain the light.
It's lost, isn't it? I mean, at the end of Return of the Jedi, where they're all just having a bit of a party with the Ewoks. And I mean, the Ewoks are using Stormtrooper helmets as drums.
Yeah. But it also...
Those men are dead.
It also reinforces the idea that I think Rian Johnson has that kind of correct irreverence almost for the original trilogy, is that when Star Wars Return of the Jedi finishes, the work isn't completed.
Yeah.
That's one small victory. And what is the price of that? What is the price against war? And that's a question that Rian Johnson poses throughout this. I thought that was an excellent opening.
No, absolutely, I agree. And there's just reminds me of, I'm going to go off on a bit of a tangent here. It just reminds me of, there's a nice interview in this month's Empire magazine with Tim Rose, who is the puppeteer behind Admiral Akbar.
Oh, really?
And he says, in Return of the Jedi, he nearly got the sack, because in the scene where they find, you know, they blow up the Death Star again and everyone's celebrating, he decided to just have Akbar. And we see it in the film, Akbar sort of slumps in his chair and he's just like, oh, you know, he puts his head in his hands. And the director said, what are you doing? Why, you know, you're supposed to be celebrating. And,
yeah.
And Tim Rose said, he said, well, I just thought, you know, Akbar, he's a soldier. He's worked his way up to Admiral. He probably just actually is a bit just...
Sick of it.
Sick of the whole thing and victory, but also...
But again, at what cost? Kind of thing.
You know.
Because Akbar is actually killed in this without almost even a second thought.
Yes.
And that's why I thought, they are war movies. It says so in the title. And not everyone gets out unscathed. I actually felt, leading back into our Finn conversation, I didn't like the whole kind of detour to Monaco or whatever it was.
Yeah,
Galactic
Space
Monaco.
Mark,
I just didn't get that.
Space Monte Carlo.
Yeah, I just thought that was a bit. And the criticism of the kind of the higher class, lower class thing would have been
a little on the nose.
It was on the nose. It could have been interesting, perhaps in an anthology movie, or if they'd held it. Things were seemingly too pressing for them to be worrying about that.
Yeah, and if I were to criticise this film to some degree. Because, it is easy to get caught up in Star Wars and really love the sci-fi and
Definitely.
The adventure and the scope of it. But it's very long, 152 minutes.
And that's what I'm saying, we could have exercised that. And I'll be honest with you, the way they set up
there are
Finn...
a few endings. it feels like...
Return of the King.
Yeah, you could have ended it. Oh, that's the end of this film. Oh, no, wait, there's now another little bit. And you think... Oh,
and that's it. And that's why I think, because he was throwing the dice on all these different characters, and with Finn, who I loved in The Force Awakens, part of me did feel like... How they set things up in this movie, he is channeling towards the what did they call it in the movie? I can't remember. It was like the mini Death Star tank, the battering ram kind of thing. I can't remember.
Yes,
they have a name for it.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and I did think it would have probably been more satisfying to have seen him make that ultimate sacrifice.
Yes, and I have to say, all credit to Rian Johnson. The amount of people he was sort of killing off throughout this film, willy nilly,
like George R. R. Martin, wasn't he?
Without any consideration for the fans.
I tell you what,
crazy
Dan,
theories.
He's been banned in local schools. I tell you now, he's.
You know, I do not know what is going to happen to any of these characters.
Mm.
You know, the way, in, you know, Rian Johnson seems like the man who would very easily just have that the Resistance cruiser with all the main characters on, blow it up.
See what happens. And that's what I think is that
Without a second thought,
part of me does wonder now, like, where do we go? Because I do think that this movie, at least the mechanics behind it, Johnson subverts many of them, but the mechanics were, well, is the continuation, right?
Yeah.
Rey and Luke are going to go off together, Ren's going to regroup with Snoke, Finn's going to go off and regenerate and kind of stuff like that, and we'll see what happens from there on in. I'll be honest with you, I haven't got a clue what the third film's going to be about. I have no idea.
And neither, presumably, do they. I mean, you know, we know perfectly well that, basically, you know, Abrams finished Force Awakens, and it was handed over to Rian Johnson. There was apparently an outline. Johnson said, can I do my own one?
And
they said, all right, fine. And they're very much, you know, I mean, the Star Wars, you know, the higher-ups, Kennedy et al., have, you know, come under a bit of scrutiny recently. They sacked Miller and Lord, didn't they, from the Han Solo film. They've just sacked Colin Trevorrow from Episode 9 in favour of bringing Abrams back.
But they took Jar Jar Binks out and shot him in front of his family.
But then, you know, they do seemingly, that, you know, when they have a filmmaker that they're perfectly, if they're fully behind them, and they said, you know, yeah, you...
Ryan Johnson's now about to embark on a new trilogy.
He gets his own trilogy, and you know, so, yeah, you can do these, you can do whatever you want with these characters.
And he lives up to...
Don't mind where you go.
To talk about how he uses characters almost as his own mouthpiece, or at least he uses characters as like meta-criticism. We're speaking about that, you know, this is not going to go the way you think. Mm. If you think about Kylo Ren's voice in the trailer where he says, you know, let the past die, kill it if you need to. Well, he has a bloody good go. It's an attempted murder in this movie. And you know, for the fandom, perhaps evil in places, but necessary evil. If we want Star Wars to continue and march on for the next however many years and outlive us together, it has to evolve. It's got to mutate. And The Last Jedi throws the gauntlet down in fairly spectacular fashion. It does retain sentimentality. Skywalker, Leia, even Yoda pops up, and I didn't feel like that was too ham-fisted.
No, that worked. That worked very well. I sat there thinking, I was like, it's a shame that we can't get Alec Guinness back.
But
Guy,
phone ringing off the hook.
Alec Guinness.
You know, Star Wars is going to be like an Eddie Murphy film with him at some point, isn't it? But at least he had that sentimentality, but it kind of... To coin a phrase from another franchise, it is boldly going places where Star Wars has never been before.
Yes.
I think that might lead us on to Bob's, Dan.
Well, I want to talk about Brick a bit more.
Shall we?
Just briefly.
Have we got time? Yeah, go on then. Right, sod the other stuff. It's all rubbish anyway. Okay, let's go on. Going back to Brick.
This is not the views of One Room Overview.
Yeah. Or Mark Hamill.
Well, I just want to talk very briefly. I wanted to touch a bit more on Johnson's filmmaking. We talked, you know, he wrote this and we talked about, you know, and... He has a very, you know, it's a Rian Johnson film.
Very idiosyncratic way, isn't it?
Yes.
Brick, Looper, and The Last Jedi, and even to a certain degree...
The Brothers Bloom as well, from a few years ago.
And even to a certain degree, those Breaking Bad episodes we spoke about all live within this kind of, you know, there is authorial intent that Rian Johnson throughout.
And, I mean, there are some wonderful moments in both. I love the opening to Brick, the way that shot with... Brendan looking over the body of a victim. She's lying there in this sewered outlet tunnel, and every shot of her is not actually a shot. It's not, those shots aren't possible from his point of view. It's all very scrambled, and some people might say, well, that's just bad editing on the part of the filmmaker. But there's something about it. I think it really worked as an establishing, establishing a few shots. This is, you know, this is very noir. Brendan is a detective. He's taking in the details. We don't need to kind of see it from his point of view. There's lots of things that don't make sense throughout this film. There's a lot of things that, you know, throughout the film, there's a lot of things that are very bizarre.
Purposely misleading, I suppose. I just like the idea of him taking these tropes, not unlike what he does in The Last Jedi, taking tropes, subverting them, playing around with them, and having fun with them.
Yeah.
And I think a more shallow director would have played it for laughs, and actually most of this movie is played straight.
Yeah.
You know, a murder has happened.
People die in this film.
Yeah.
High school kids die.
Yeah, and I mean... In harrowing fashion as well, many of them. And you've got this whole idea of Class A drugs, and that's permeating forth through high school culture and stuff like that. And it's not perfect. I think in some cases, perhaps we were saying earlier, it does skirt round the edges of pastiche and falls down that rabbit hole on occasion. I think my main issue with it is... Johnson is so fastidiously dedicated to the concept that sometimes it loses gravitas. And I found it in some ways quite difficult to invest in many of the characters, purely because they seem like contemporary versions of tropes more. And I kind of understand the decision in making that. It's just on a human level, I think I found it very difficult to kind of stick a hook in.
Okay, no, I get that.
But it was a perfectly enjoyable movie.
Yeah, no, it's great. Like, I mean, an amazing debut.
Yeah,
for any director.
And I'm excited by him as a director. Like, I didn't come out of either movie. I mean, I wish I'd seen Brick back in the day. I saw Looper in cinemas, as I said, watched Breaking Bad when it was aired, and have now watched The Last Jedi in cinemas. And I do wonder what this man's going to be doing next. I think that having watched both of these movies today, which I had back to back, and thinking about his future. The future is franchising, isn't it? And I think people are kind of coming round to that idea now. And, you know, this Disney-Fox deal that's recently happened or is currently undergoing and things like that, it does start to send this kind of beacon of terror, if you want, about this idea of individual, independent filmmaking. But at the same time, if it's scooping up talents like Rian Johnson and they're able to kind of do something unique and individual within that set universe, part of me is kind of like, well, you know, the future is here. The future is Rian Johnson.
I, for one, welcome our new Johnson overlords.
Yeah. Should we Bob it?
Yes, Bob. That's Bob's.
Right. What are we doing first? Brick?
Brick.
I'm going with three Bob for Brick, and that might sound harsh, but I think it lives up to that tablet that we outlined a short time ago of the three Bob movie, being a perfectly enjoyable afternoon, evening, whilst you won't necessarily remember it after the credits roll. I think it was a great debut. It was the spark that lit the fire, Dan, Rian Johnson.
Nice.
But it's not necessarily... It's probably something that I'll come back to again in a few years.
It's maybe not an instant classic.
Yeah, there's something more of the cult about it.
Yeah, it's a curio. Yeah. I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad we decided to do that particular film for this podcast. I, too, will give it a three Bob rating. As I say, I really enjoyed the filmmaking. I enjoyed this sort of noir, hard-boiled detective story set on campus.
Yeah, it's a clever notion.
The score is brilliant, I should just point out.
Was it his brother?
Cousin, I believe.
Oh, cousin, okay. Brother. I know it's a fan, familiar,
who apparently has scored most of his films except
The
Jedi,
Last Jedi, yeah.
Because, of course,
Williams
Mr. John Williams, Esquire, was his first refusal.
I just imagine him coming out of a trailer with, like, a rifle going, get off my lawn! Yeah, absolutely.
Last Jedi.
I am going to go with a high four for this movie, and that's my head talking rather than my heart. And actually, I'm glad that you said...
Because I've had enough of your damn heart.
My damn heart talking. But when you turned around and said, we have to step out of that magicness of the Star Wars movie, we have to step out of that midnight screening ethos, if you want, to the movie. If you look at it just as a movie, I think that Rian Johnson has done something truly wonderful. And in fact, actually, I would love to look forward... I'd love to look back at this movie in a couple of years when no doubt we're sat here talking about episode 9. And I think that this will be a great retrospective. I think that this will do... We'll go back to this movie in several years and go, oh, it would be blah, blah, blah. We'll have an even better opinion of it or an even worse opinion. And I really applaud the irreverent, bold choices that Rian Johnson makes. I just don't think everything pays off. And when I look at things like the whole Finn and Rose escapade around, as we said, Intergalactic Monte Carlo, when I think about underuse again of Captain Phasma, like, Gwendolyn Christie must be pissed. Like, to have been so underused in The Force Awakens and come back just to die in The Last Jedi. I do think that things like that undercut what could have been a really spectacular movie. But I do look forward to coming back to this film again and again.
Yes.
So a high four.
I think a four from me as well. And as I said at the beginning, this was a wholly unexpected film experience for me, for a Star Wars film. You know, I mean, we've had enough of them. And when you think, what could anyone possibly bring to this or do to these films that would be in any way surprising? Rian Johnson had a surprise every 20 minutes.
That's true.
Like, you know, some new thing, some unexpected twist.
And it's funny that...
Really kept you on your toes.
And it's funny that people undoubtedly talk about this and The Empire Strikes Back, which this really is not an Empire Strikes Back 2.0.
No, as much
as people thought it might be. It probably has more in common with A New Hope, with that idea of going into a film, uncertain...
It
constantly pulling the rug underneath your feet and blasting us off into a galaxy far, far away, into newness. And I think that's what Rian Johnson's done so brilliantly. As I said, neither one of us now can call what will happen in that final.
No, he's torn up the rule book. There's no knowing where it's going to go from here, and that's incredibly exciting. A
frankly, my year, I don't give a damn.
I'd forgotten about that.
It's back.
It's back.
It's back for its annual air out.
Oh, Lord.
Humphrey Bogart just spinning in his grave so, this week.
So every year, Christopher and I, well, as part of the wider ORWAV team as well, everyone in ORWAV puts together a top 20.
And because ORWAV is bigger than the rebellion at the end of The Last Jedi, I think, at the moment. Yeah. I don't know what old Snoke Break has been up to, but he's assembled a cast of thousands.
Yes.
So we do have quite possibly
our own
the most
supreme leader.
It ends up with perhaps the most eclectic top 10 maybe online because of just the amount of contributors. So this is mine and Dan's individual top tens that then get fed into the matrix.
Yes, and everything gets assigned a certain number of points, and everything's to play for right until the last minute.
Yeah. Can you remember what number one was last year?
It was Arrival.
Ah, yes, of course.
Starred Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner, which is a film I've not seen since.
Yeah, and not one that I think it might have made my top 20, but it certainly didn't make my top 10.
Yes. My problem with that film was that they...
You haven't seen it?
No. They told they, yes, I hate it. I've never seen it. Someone said, oh, it's a great twist. So I went in expecting there to be something. Yeah, so, and it's not the film you can go and watch. Sorry if I've ruined it.
I remember when I was at university.
You've had 365 days to see
it. I remember when I was at university, I'd never seen the Usual Suspects. And Freshers Week, I said, oh, I'm just going around so-and-so's room. They're playing the Usual Suspects. And the guy replied, is that the one where...
Oh, God,
and
no.
I looked at him. It was like someone had backed into my car, honestly. Right, anyway.
So, my number 10, my 10 in my top 10 is... and this surprised even myself. Logan.
Excellent.
I'm putting Logan in at my...
Great movie.
To go back to what we were talking about in Something Old, Something New, Logan is, like, honestly, I know people talk about, like, superhero films going to places that haven't been to before and all being, you know... Thor Ragnarok was so like unlike anything Marvel had done, and you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was so unlike anything. Logan is unlike any superhero film that we've had in the last few years,
and likely probably ever to have. Certainly in the foreseeable future.
It was a very, I mean, what James Mangold and Hugh Jackman have managed to pull off is nothing short of a miracle when it comes to actually like putting a little bit, you know, revitalising the concept of superhero films.
And also, as a threequel, and that kind of word unto itself has got baggage,
yes,
to say the
considering
least.
Considering the disappointment that the two Wolverine stand-alone films have been.
I love parts of the Wolverine, but I think I love the train sequence,
yes,
for example.
Yeah.
And Hugh Jackman has been consistently amazing in this role. But my God, that first one, the one with... to think Logan is a threequel to a movie franchise that began with Hugh Jackman standing side by side with Will I Am. Like, my God, this man and this character has come a long way.
Yeah, no, great... for that reason, yeah, it makes it into my top 10. Like, it's now my number 10. What's yours?
Okay, mine is A Monster Calls, and that's a movie that I saw on the 1st of January 2017. And it is a movie that joins the ranks of only Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3 to make me cry in the cinema. And what could have been a movie that was chock full of cheap sentiment and manipulation tactics, actually, to use this word again, the word of the day, actually provides us with a real nuanced look at grief.
Mm.
And the only thing that's worse than death, which is arguably dying, and I thought that it was really quite magnificent.
And
to
watching someone die.
And watching someone die. And I thought that all of the actors and the cast and characters and everything involved in it was tremendous. And I do love to see Liam Neeson as a talking tree. And it was wonderful. It was an emotional experience. And I left the cinema affected. And I think when you're trying to choose a top 10, I try and choose films that linger with me. Mm. And that movie has lingered with me for nearly 12 months. So that's in at 10.
A good choice. My number 9 is the Lego Batman movie.
Oh, what fun. What tremendous fun.
Because it is just tremendous fun. I love the Lego movie. I love this. Will Arnett as Bruce Wayne and Batman returning, reprising his role from the Lego movie from a few years ago, which we loved on an earlier podcast. You know, they managed to come back and do it again and create one of the best Batman films in recent years.
And create something that was just so reverent to, like, it's a museum, a treasure trove of Batman Easter eggs.
Well, we have talked about it, I think, in a previous podcast. And
possibly.
And I very much, I think we sort of maybe mentioned this. If we haven't, I'm mentioning it now. It is a love letter to Batman. And the comic series.
Yeah.
And to Adam West.
And perfectly straddles that kind of Adam West, the Adam West stuff alongside all of the new stuff too, which is really lovely.
But yes, it's good, as you say, tremendous fun. So that's in at number nine.
Number nine for me is Call Me By Your Name, which is a movie that I was fortunate enough to see in the Berlinale this year. And it's just a wonderful love story. And I remember in my review, I think I said, I hate doing those, you know, a lot of reviewers and a lot of people talk about movies being X meets Y.
Yes.
And I always think that that's kind of reductive, but at the same time, I feel like this movie has the best of both worlds from Richard Linklater before movies and Brokeback Mountain. And it's just a very wonderful coming of age story and a summer romance at the same time. And it's got one of the best performances of the year, Timothée Chalamet, and possibly one of the most emotionally wrenching subtle endings that I've seen in years, so it really again stayed with me, so that would be number nine for me.
I've not seen it, so I'll have to check that one out.
Put that on the catch up list. Yeah,
for sure. So in at number eight for me is a film I talked about I think last month, or certainly in the last one of the more recent podcasts, possibly one of the funniest films of the year and one of the darkest, The Death of Stalin.
Yeah, I caught that after you spoke to me about it.
What did you think in the end? Because I don't think we've talked about it since.
I think I was...
You said terrifying. You said it was a terrifying
movie. Like, much more... It was... I mean, I just binged the thick of it.
Right.
In the lead up.
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest that.
I binged the thick of it, which I love that sitcom, and then walked straight into The Death of Stalin. And I was surprised at just how much of a shiver it put down my spine.
The final 15 minutes.
And I don't think I've seen a performance... I mean, Simon Russell Beale's performance in this movie is just something that I'll be talking about for years.
Mm. I mean, that man's an incredible actor, and he's certainly... I mean, it's something of a, I think, a crime that he hasn't had more of these sorts of film roles. He's very much... I mean, he's a stage actor, first and foremost, and is well-known and respected on the stage.
Yeah.
He was in Spooks for a short while as the Home Secretary.
Yeah.
So he has his TV experience. But the man can act, and
he's amazing.
You know, he's an unusual-looking man, so he doesn't get to do...
He is, but I just think that... I just hope this is a movie in which people notice him more.
Yeah.
No. I want to see more of him.
Yeah, it was an amazing... Yeah, a terrifying, but a laugh-out-loud, funny film.
Eight for me is Star Wars: The Last Jedi. I was hoping, if I'm being brutally honest, I was hoping this movie would be much higher than it is in my list.
Mm.
But I can't because of those little niggling thoughts that I've had. However, Star Wars: The Last Jedi has provided me with some of the most magical and exciting and euphoric moments that I've experienced in the last 12 months inside the cinema. And because of the sheer emotional energy it charges me with, and because of those bold, irreverent, cataclysmic choices that Rian Johnson's made, it had to make the top 10 at least, and so it comes in at number 8.
That's very good. Okay. In at 7 for me is, I think, well, perhaps Andy Serkis's best performance this year, the second one being The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
But this one is War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Which is...
give this guy an Oscar for crying out loud.
One of the best war movies that I've ever watched, and not just war movies about apes against humans. It's just in terms of being a war epic, it's amazing. Andy Serkis is, as always, you know, I think we've touched on this before, you know, a powerhouse. Woody Harrelson as the general.
Because we spoke about this in our apes podcast, didn't we, over the summer?
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think we both kind of concluded that we were surprised at just how harrowing this movie was for a 12A franchise blockbuster movie in the summer.
Yes, about motion capture, you know, with people dressed up as apes.
This is a movie that should be really put alongside the likes of Avatar in terms of just being, to coin a ubiquitous phrase, the game changer, the visuals that they...
I was going to say, we've talked about this before, and I think if any film, in terms of, like, technological advancements, and you know, you have monkeys riding horses in snow, and it looks real.
Mm.
It's an incredible achievement.
Was that not real?
they really trained those circus animals.
Peter just having a field day. In at number 7 for me is Blade Runner 2049.
Another one I missed, unfortunately.
Which is just the bleakest...
To see Death of Stalin, I think.
Yeah, it's just the bleakest kind of huge... I don't really call it a blockbuster movie, but it kind of does tick off a lot of the blockbuster hallmarks.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a $180 million movie, so I don't really know what else to
call
it.
And no one saw it.
And no one went to go and see it. And I kind of, again, to go back to like Rian Johnson, I have to applaud the director's blatant kind of shrug at general audiences, because it sticks so fastidiously close to a 30-year-old cult classic, which no one went to go and see in the first place. And it is undeniably, this is not a all singing, all dancing, let's jazzify it and reboot this franchise. This is absolutely the sequel that Blade Runner deserves.
Right.
And I'm so glad it got. And there are, it's haunting, this film, more than anything else.
Yeah.
The questions and answers it provides on us as a species and where we're going, it's something that will linger with you. And I know I keep using that word, but it's something that there is something about this movie that remains with you long after the credits tumble down. And I would invite you to watch this movie as soon as you can. Perhaps if you can, I know the not to plug the Prince Charles Cinema, but I know they're doing like a double.
Right.
And I'd love to see these movies back to back. So
okay.
In at number 7 for me.
In at number 6, Moonlight.
What a beautiful film.
We've talked about films already on this list, and I think very much this is a theme that's running throughout the top tens. For me, I can't speak for you, but I have a feeling not far off, but films that touch you in some way, affect you in some way, and stay with you. You know, Moonlight, I happened to catch very late on after its release.
Had it won?
I think it had won Best Picture by this point. I just thought, it's about time I go and see this. And, I mean, it's just... A beautifully made, quiet, you know, unassuming film about an incredible, you know, just an amazing story of a young man coming to terms with his sexuality, and
like a contemporary look at what masculinity is as well. I thought was the most interesting thing about Moonlight.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good, yeah. No, that's a good point.
It's funny, actually, because I've often been quite critical of the idea of top 20s, because I feel like they're just, like, too long and endlessly verbose. But it's funny, because Moonlight is actually in number 15 on my top 20, and I'm so pleased that we're actually doing 20 in the site this year. There's so many good movies that have come out.
There have been a lot, yeah.
In at number 6 for me is Silence, Martin Scorsese movie came out in
January.
Right
out at the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah, so... I loved this movie because I thought it was a really mature and very vast look at the process and whole idea of faith and having faith.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people thought it was a bit too long, it was a bit too drab.
Not enough gangsters.
There was no gangsters in it.
Hell of the gangsters.
When I went to go and see it in January, someone came out and you could tell all these proper geezers come in for it. They all sat, and then what unfolded was Andrew Garfield wrestling with his... Catholic faith for 3 hours, and when he came out, one of the blokes walked out and he went, "That was the biggest load of shit I've ever seen." And I just, because I was sat there kind of quite like undone and dislocated from this movie, and but I thought this was excellent. It got Adam Driver in it as well, we were just speaking about, and it is long and exhausting, but purposefully so. And I think it's I think Scorsese, I don't think this man has done a bad film in years, and I thought it was a real antithetical, interesting contrast point with The Wolf of Wall Street. they curiously contain the same themes,
yes,
but
two vastly different ends.
Yeah, so that's in at number 6 for me.
It was a great choice. 5, halfway through. This is a film I saw only a couple of weeks ago,
sure,
and I loved it. It made me very sad, but also oddly nostalgic for my own childhood, and just the innocence and, you know, the sort of ignorance of youth, the glorious ignorance of youth, The Florida Project.
I haven't seen that yet, and I'm so gutted that I haven't, because that's not going to be... I'm not going to be able to see it before my top 10, so... I'd love to hear.
I implore you to go and watch it. It's, you know, I'm sure you know it's, you know, this is, it's about a mother, a single mother, and her 5-year-old daughter living, you know, living precariously in Florida.
Yeah.
Just outside, like on the very doorstep of Disney World, or Disneyland, whichever one is in Florida.
It's Disney World, yeah.
Yeah, on the doorsteps of Disney World, and they are living in poverty, more or less.
One, William Dafoe's in it.
Willem Dafoe plays the kind-hearted manager of the motel in which they live. And this is the situation for many millions of Americans who find themselves after the crash, you know, after 2008's crash, with no money, no savings, and no roof over their heads, and are living in motels, which are designed for holidaymakers. And these characters have to sort of up sticks and go somewhere else every couple of weeks to make sure they're not being seen as permanent residents of a hotel.
Oh, fascinating.
And this is going on and it's happening. But at the same time, it's all pretty much told from the point of view of Mooney, this little girl. And she's perfectly content. She's got everything she wants, and she has no idea of the grim reality of what is awaiting her as she gets older.
There was a couple of films last year that I just think Patterson and Your Name, I remember, came out last year, and I had to scoop them up in January. I think there was another showing of them somewhere that we saw Your Name together, didn't
we? Yes.
I think Florida Project is doomed. It's just not one that I could find in time, unfortunately.
It reminded me. I mean, I didn't grow up in anything like this, obviously. But
you grew up in a palace, didn't you?
I did grow up in a palace, yes.
The shell.
It's a small castle, I think, actually. Yeah. But the idea of spending long summers running around fields and in forests with your friends, and your parents not caring where you are, or seemingly not, you know, you don't care where you're, that your parents don't care where you are, and you could do anything, and you have no sense of danger or fear. And the whole summer stretches before you.
Well, you certainly sold it. I'm desperate to go and see that movie now that you've said it.
What's yours, number five?
Number five for me is The Handmaiden. Park Chan-wook's very long...
Romantic comedy?
very long, very insidious, twisty, turny thriller movie. Mm. And there's not a huge amount I can really tell you about it without spoiling things, but... The movie is chaptered, and purposefully so, is all I'll say. Mm. And it looks at the toxic nature of relationships and how we may well view them to harrowing effect. It's a movie that will keep you on the edge of your seat throughout. And it's a long, long film. I think I saw the director's cut again at the Prince Charles, I think very early on in the year. I know it was on wide release after that. It's on DVD and Blu-ray now, so if you can, I think it might even be on Amazon Prime if you've got that.
Take a look.
So do take a look, and I invite the audience to do so too. Really twisty, turny, thrilling thriller.
Great. Well, in number four is a film you've already mentioned, and I had to put it this far up mainly for many of the reasons that you mentioned. You know, the fact that you this film gave you such, you know, joy and amazement. Star Wars: The Last Jedi is my number four, and as I say, we've already talked about it. You know, I wasn't expecting any of this, so I think just for sheer, you know,
ballsiness,
I'm like, you deserve your place in the top five.
Right, so number four for me is A Ghost Story, which was a movie that I think a lot of people spoke about, because I think there's a 7-minute sequence in which
Rooney Mara eats a pie.
But actually, in the context of the film, that 7-minute sequence is totally, well, maybe not entirely justified, but mostly justified. You know, Paul Hollywood makes a little cameo, I think, at some point. But actually, again, talking about A Monster Calls, this is a movie that debates and discusses the notions of grief, and from the perspective of a ghost who's in a like Halloween-y kind of bedsheet costume.
Played by Casey Affleck.
He's just wandering around in a sheet the whole time. But
we're told it's Casey Affleck. Well,
yeah, but it just discusses these notions of grief, and but also about the human condition, about our place within the universe, and us being little tiny specks in this vast expanse of a Jackson Pollock painting.
Yeah.
And I really think that some of the ideas it threw up and that how it did, and it's a very short, I think it's only an hour and a half, it's like a 90-something minute movie, 92-minute movie,
something
like
that. A very short film. I mean, you know,
yeah,
I think a 90-minute film is the perfect length for a film.
But this is a 92-minute movie in which barely anyone speaks, so, and a man is wandering around with a
with a bedsheet on his head. A good third of it is devoted to baking.
Yeah, I was going to say, in seven minutes of which of that is just a woman eating this pie. But it's a very, very fascinating film, and one that isn't arrogant enough to provide answers to the question it asks, and I liked it all the more for that.
Mm. In at number three for me is, again, another film that's already appeared on your list, and I don't want to go too much into it because you touched on so many good points, A Monster Calls. And this is purely because I haven't really... I feel like barely a day goes by where I don't think about this particular film. And you just, you know, as you said, the way it handles grief and loss and dying is done in... It's so deft. Mm. And doesn't get mawkish or over sentimental, and as you said, you know, the actors, all, you know, bear in mind the main character is this young boy. He does a brilliant job. Liam Neeson as the monster, again great. And I just wanted, I will touch on something you did mention there, but the throughout this film, listeners, if you've not seen it, the monster tells three stories, and they're all animated in different ways. It's very akin to, I think, how Harry Potter did it in the Deathly Hallows sequence. Very similar.
You're absolutely
very
right,
different
the three
style.
Brothers, yeah.
But just beautiful animations in a live-action film. And
it's a gorgeous film. I think not as many people have seen it as they should. Like, if you can go and see it and it's in the sale or it's on one of the streaming platforms, whatever, do see this movie,
but yeah,
immediately.
As Preston, I can't, you know, it made me weep towards the end.
Number three for me is probably the zeitgeist movie of the year. Maybe, yeah, probably up there with Star Wars. It's Get Out. Jordan Peele's kind of racial horror movie, or I suppose you would call it that. Certainly a very, very topical, satirical horror film.
Yes.
Which I think is, dare I say, the most fun I've had in the cinema. It's wickedly funny. Genuinely scary.
Yes.
And, like sharply intelligent. To think that this is one of several of these kind of socially aware horrors, I think, that Peele's said them to be, this is one in like an anthology, is greatly exciting to me. And this is a film that I saw twice in the cinema, have watched it subsequently on DVD with my parents, who also loved this. And it's a film that, as at school, I'm a school teacher and I do a Key Stage 5 film club, and I'm about to show this in January, and already a record amount of students are saying they want to come and see this film. So there's not really much more to say about it if you haven't seen it, but it's just brilliant. It's fantastic. It's one of those films that is hyped to absolute death, but actually manages to surpass
it. It doesn't let you down in the slightest.
No, it's a great film.
So my number two film, as we slowly hone in on the end of the list here, my number two is a film that I'm certain isn't going to be in your list now.
Okay.
And I know you didn't like it as much as I did.
All right.
This is Jackie.
No, Jackie was not. I can tell you where Jackie is on my list, actually. He's number 45
that's insane.
45 out of 71.
I'm insulted. Jackie, I mean, Natalie Portman puts in a tour de force in this
film. She
does. The fact that she lost the Oscar to Emma Stone, being kooky old Emma Stone, is criminal. This film was great. It was a perfect biopic, snapshot of a person's life in an incredibly important period, and a fascinating look at how the winners, the victors, shape history, and how history is made. Because history isn't objective. History is incredibly subjective, and this is an amazing example of how it is, you know, how it's crafted.
And
by
it's a fascinating portrait that's hung slightly askew, isn't it? You know, like, I felt that when I walked out of this film that this is a movie that Jackie O herself would have signed off on. It brings a reverence to her being an architect of history herself.
Yes, and not just the wife of the president or the widow of the president.
Probably one of those movies that I should come back to.
And as I say, Natalie Portman she becomes Jackie Kennedy in this film.
Yeah, I do remember going down a stroll on the Uncanny Valley. This is a few weeks after Rogue One as well. There's a part where she's talking to a journalist, I think, and the way that she's holding the cigarette and moving her mouth really freaked me out at how close that was. And I thought, yeah, you're right. She should have got the Oscar for this, much more so than... I know she did brilliantly in Black Swan, but this felt like a movie that she should have and could have won an Oscar
for. No, she's one of our, you know, this generation's most talented actresses. Mm. And a lovely final performance from John Hurt to boot.
Of course.
As well.
Who actually does speak about the notions of death, doesn't he? And things like that. So,
yes,
yeah, you're
to
right.
keep the theme going. Goodbye, your number two.
Number two for me is La La Land, a film that I was... a film that I was very, very euphoric about at the beginning of last season, I think it was, Dan.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember making you promises that ultimately I couldn't keep. I love this movie. I saw it at the BFI last October, not the one just gone, the one before that, when it debuted, and I worried that it was going to be this mawkish, overly colourful, e-numbery kind of musical. But actually, I really, really enjoyed it. It was very, very happy and cheerful film up until it isn't, and I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And I thought that the epilogue or the final chapter, however you want to kind of phrase it, is masterful storytelling in a way that could have been lazy in anyone else's hands. But Damien Chazelle, who we've given props to since Whiplash, manages to make it something that's heart-wrenching and interesting more than just manipulative.
Yes, I will. I mean, I will argue that the final sequence, the dream sequence, if you will,
yeah,
is certainly one of the best sequences in film of 2017.
Definitely,
for sure.
I can't wait to find out what your number one.
My number one is, and again, this is a film you've already brought up, and I mean, I will keep it brief because for all the reasons you nailed it on the head.
La La Land.
Yes, a film that I famously...
And we've got Ryan and Emma into the hay, thanks so much.
Sorry if I just said that about your Oscar win there, Emma. Totally deserve you.
You're brilliant, cookie. Yeah. And Emma will be in Jackie 2, coming out.
Jackie 2. Jackie goes to Greece. No, my number one is Get Out. You hit the nail on the head.
Okay, I'll leave. What's your number one? Rubbish. Just rubbish. Oh, my Lord.
Oh, my. Go on, then. What's yours?
Good film. My number one is OJ Made in America. A film that when Mr. Brake sent me a message and said, do you want to come and watch a 9 or 8 hour?
I mean, I was going to say, this film is 3 days long, isn't it?
I think it's close to 8 hours. Certainly over 7 hours. I think 7.5 hours. Went to go and see this movie in, I think it was the Bloomsbury Curzon, I think I'm saying, in the Dock House. And David Brake, our esteemed editor, said, oh, we should, you know, come and see this film with us. So I was like, right, I'll go along. And it took a whole day out. You know, it literally took a whole day to watch this film. It was so good, Dan, that I went back the following weekend to watch it again. And I bought it day one on Blu-ray, and I made my wife, admittedly, in a more episodic fashion, but we watched it. So I've seen this movie 3 times. It's taken nearly a whole day of 2017 out. And I would
worry about your sanity.
It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. As a documentary, it's wonderful. It kind of brings a pulpy... this to the juice, I suppose, if you want to use a pun, to the OJ story. Because the thing is,
not at all inappropriate.
I don't think there's been a story probably as widely told as the OJ murders case.
Well, I've never heard of him. So
yeah, all right. Like, he should have been on the jury then. Yeah. They were really down to the last knockings there. But this story has been so widely pulled apart and picked about, and obviously they recently did the Showtime, The People versus O.J. Simpson, and all that kind of stuff. But the fact that really Ezra Edelman puts the city of Los Angeles on trial as much as O.J.
Yeah,
and that this story has a succinct beginning, middle, and end, and the case is the middle. The beginning is OJ's reverence, his, you know, his deity-esque performances across America, and the fact he was one of the most popular sportsmen of all time, all of the ad campaigns he did, and how he became this icon. Then it's the fall from grace, and then the epilogue, the final chapter, which is just his descent into hell, essentially. It's one of the most incredible stories I've ever seen, and it luxuriates in that time that it sets out. 7.5 hours sounds epic, and it is sprawling, but it does fill up every minute purposefully. And I left this movie 7.5 hours later wanting to see it again. And I've seen it 3 times now, and I even want to see it again just to see how Ezra Edelman tells this epic story. It was a 5-bob movie, and it was always going to be the number one film of this year.
I'll try and squeeze it in before Christmas. But there you go, our listeners. My favourite film of 2017, Get Out. And Christopher's favourite film there, OJ...
Made in America.
Made in America.
Yeah.
Go see them if you can.
Frankly, my year, I don't give a damn. Housekeeping. Don't have a jingle for that, Dan.
No, never have, never will.
And it's the last one for 2017. So
yes.
It's been an interesting episode. I know we jettisoned a lot of the other features, but I do think what we've spoken about needed, almost in Ezra Edelman-esque fashion, that luxury of time. So I hope that it hasn't been too indulgent for you, listener, and that you'll be back.
Yes, sort of bumper. I mean, we kind of went a bit crazy on the old Star Wars there, but there's so much to talk about.
So much to talk about. And our top tens as well. I'm hoping that we've at least provided some curios for the audience there, that if you haven't seen them and you're trying to get your own top tens curated before New Year's Eve, then perhaps you can try and check some of those out. And do email us. We're podcast@oneroomwithaview.com. You can find us on Facebook, One Room With A View, on Twitter, @OneRoomWithAView, numerical one. I'm @ThePrestonEye and you're @Mr. Orton.
Yeah.
We should mention the site, Dan, shouldn't we?
I suppose so.
So, where are we from?
We are from OneRoomWithAView.com. And you can follow the website on Twitter, @OneRoomWithAView. That's a numerical one. We're on Instagram as
well. Everywhere you can find us.
Search One Room of a View, it's going to come up. It's
and
a great blog.
I'll be honest with you, with regards to our top tens, we've mentioned it very briefly, but it's a very eclectic top ten. I think there's like 30-odd people on the staff or something like that, and everyone gets a fair say. So if you start to look at the blog in the next kind of week or so from publishing, we do an initial...
We're
going to
be doing our 20 to 11 early next week.
And that's like a paragraph per, isn't it? And then after that, there's 10 essays, essentially, that come out from those who loved the film the most. So it's going to be brilliant. It's definitely worth having a look at.
Looking forward to your essay on OJ Made in America.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm hoping that my points are enough to drag it into into the top 10, but we'll have to see. Other than that, we'll be back in the new year.
Yes, we hope you have a Merry Christmas and cheerio.